talking about demons. What are the demons?
Voices.
Tell me about them. What are the voices about?
It's another voice, the evil side.
Yeah, whatever your name is, Satan.
Hey guys, Aaron here from Evil Examined. Just wanted to show a little love to a couple of authors that support the show or take a look at the social media accounts. You know, normally we don't have advertisements on the program, so this will be really quick, but if you guys are into horror books, please check out Alexis Sundquist. Her book, What Crawls Below, is going to be coming out June 30th, so go ahead and look for that in paperback and Kindle on Amazon. It follows a boy who's being touted as a messiah to a doomsday cult and his struggle between accepting the duty or saving humanity. Sounds pretty cool. A young author, you know, so support kind of the up-and-coming. I believe she has a couple other things available on Amazon, too. So go ahead and check out Alexis Sundquist. Also, take a look at Timothy Freisenen. He's got a book that's going to be released, I think, in July. You can pre-order now on Kindle. It's called The Eternal, and it's about a girl who finds herself trying to escape the abusive wrath of her mother. The teen with blood-red eyes wasn't aware of who she was and who she was to become. An ancient being as old as time puts forth a plan of total annihilation of mankind. Opposite of the evil ancient being lies a counterpart. Her name is Eden, and her lineage is mankind's last hope. Sounds pretty cool. I believe he also has one other book, too, so go ahead and check him out. And last but not least, yours truly, Aaron Beauregard. I'm releasing my horror collection, Dark Assembly, which is a brutal, disturbing book. If you're easily offended, definitely probably stay away from this one. You should be able to tell just from the cover artwork. But be on the lookout for that shit. I think it's going to be probably out in the next couple weeks. It's six different stories. One of them's about like a pregnant woman with a dead fetus inside her that she believes will be resurrected. Got another one about a nomadic punk rocker that comes across a sickening conundrum where he's presented with a choice to do something for money. And of course, probably the last story is the most brutal and controversial. It's called Last Days in Honduras. And it's about a sadistic pedophile who's traveling outside of the country to find a deep, dark pleasure. So that's Dark Assembly by Aaron Beauregard. Now, let's get on to the show, people. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to the Evil Examined podcast, where, last week you should have listened to our episode on the most unbelievable, well, I should say most credible UFO cases, right? But they are, in fact, unbelievable. It's a beefy topic that myself and John the Aviator took a look into with Leslie Kane's book, which is UFOs, Generals, Pilots, Government Officials Go on Record. Last week, we talked about the Belgian UFO wave, the disappearance of Frederick Valentik, and also just some other items, really. John kind of gave us a good breakdown of radar, and some other great details. So if you missed that episode, I would strongly recommend go back, listen to that one first before you jump into this one. And we ended with special guest Daddy Bass came on to discuss the O'Hare Airport UFO sighting of 2006. But we want to pick up today with that particular topic and let John weigh in on that too, being that he has the air traffic control mind frame, right, dude?
Yeah, man, this one was interesting because I actually never heard of this. And what was funny to me was that I was in college at the time that this happened. And I went to an aeronautical university. So, like, our lives all, they were, everything was on aviation. All right. We're coined aerosexuals. All right. Because, like, we just get boners about anything aviation. Right. So, the key there is that I would have heard about this, man. Like, they did a pretty good job burying this because I just never remember reading about it or hearing about it. But yeah, this was an interesting one, man. The O'Hare incident involved a lot of aviation professionals. And I mean, aviation professionals from every level, from, you could argue the baggage guy is an aviation professional. And I say that because you still go through training. You go through the trained observer training, right? Where they go through safety training. They go through how to properly conduct themselves in an airport environment, all for safety's sake. So these guys know how to keep their eyes peeled for certain things in order to, well, not get themselves killed, number one, and then second, to protect company property. So you got the baggage guys, you got airport ops, you have pilots, you have the controllers, all experience this at one of our major airports. There's only about 20 Class Bravo airspaces in the country. Class Bravo is the highest sort of protected airspace other than military in the national airspace system. And O'Hare is one of them. So for this to happen at an airport like that is pretty remarkable, and especially it happening in recent times, right? Because anytime we hear about things like this, what do we hear about? We hear 1947. We hear all back in the 70s, right? I mean, this was the era of cell phones and computers and the internet, you know? So we spoke of this before, where if this had happened a couple of years later, when everybody had an iPhone in their pocket, a smartphone in their pocket, man, it would have been a lot different, right? Because people would have been able to sort of like just pull out this pretty capable camera and just videotape the whole thing. So it didn't, but it's pretty wild, everything that happened.
Absolutely. And also, we're going to get into a quick high-level overview of the O'Hare Airport, also for the benefit of Gene, who hasn't, we haven't discussed this with him. But be sure to check out www.evilexamine.com and also the Instagram and Facebook, where we're posting up the audio and video that we can attain, and also the photographic evidence of some of the validated photos that we talk about on the show. And also check out our Extra Evil posts, which vary in topic. It could be anything. I mean, we got some on Agent Orange, serial killers.
Sci-fi.
If you want to hear about a mom putting her baby in the microwave. I mean, it's fucked up shit. You know, if you're a total derelict, you will love this shit. So subscribe, give us a review. We really need that stuff. But let's get into it, guys. Just generally speaking, not going to beat it to death because we talked about it last episode, but November 7th, 2006, during a routine afternoon hours, for the duration of approximately 5 minutes, a metallic disc-shaped object hovered over O'Hare Airport in Chicago. The craft was silent and hovered in plain sight in front of, as John said, various witnesses at about 1,500 feet. They described it as if you held up like a silver dollar at arm's length. That's essentially the size that witnesses were quoting. Then it suddenly shot up into the sky, leaving a donut-like cookie-cutter hole in the overcast clouds that were above. As John said, you know, this story was was buried for a few months until it came out, and then it became like one of the most read stories in the history of the Chicago Tribune immediately, internet-wise. But still, as you said, John, on a global scale, all things considered, it was just a drop in the bucket, and it really was not something that I was familiar with until like literally a few months ago. And I consider myself pretty well experienced in UFOs, you know what I mean? And UAP.
No. Yeah, I agree, man. And that's sort of what shocked me, was that, you know, maybe you have the story of, I don't know, 100 people watching a Little League baseball game reporting something in the middle of Kansas or something similar to that. But here you have a major U.S. airport with multiple adult professional witnesses.
Two pilots, right?
It's insane. The credibility, you know, meter is going through the roof here.
And think about it, too. This is just 5 years removed from 9/11. And there's a fucking unidentified craft above the airport. And it's essentially completely ignored, with all the highly credible witnesses in this case remained anonymous. Like we said, with American pilots, if you listen to part one, there's certainly a stigma, whereas other countries are more open to listening to the pilots. Over here, it's kind of like keep it shut down, you know, and we laugh at it, kind of. All the witness stories were nearly exactly the same. Just aside from the size estimations, and some said it was like rotating, others, and some said it was spinning. But yeah, they said they could potentially lose their job, some of them, because they were perceived as betraying United Air. And the FAA in United States, they denied anything happened, but then they had to acknowledge it when the tower tape got released, and there was like a transcript of the back and forth between them. I mean,
the tower tape was interesting because even though we only read the transcripts, it sounded like two people who were really uncomfortable and really reluctant to admit to one another, even though they had both seen the same thing, that something had happened. So they were kind of giggling, laughing, sort of saying, oh, yeah, you know, they're going to think we're crazy, sort of thing. We're like almost waiting for the other to sort of stop, you know, and say, this really happened. Like, we need to do something about it, but it never materialized.
One slight amendment on that. Like, you're definitely right. They were giggling and they felt weird. And the tower was saying, like, kind of like, oh, are you celebrating Christmas early? Like, are you high?
Right. Kind of thing. Are you drunk? Are you high? Right.
But yeah. But they both didn't see it. The object was in an area to where the tower was actually obstructed.
Okay, so only from the airport ops or the representative that called the tower was the one that
was seeing
it.
Yeah. And they're saying that, you know, the mechanics and stuff, and the people were like visibly shaken and unnerved. And I mean, this is not, you know, this is a major busy national airport, and nothing came of it really.
So that actually kind of makes sense, because at some of these bigger airports, the tower doesn't necessarily see the entire property. It's so large that they only have sort of like line of sight view of like what they need to see, pretty much. Everything else is either covered via like a ground radar with displays that you could kind of see, almost like if you were like looking at somebody on a GPS traveling around town. That's how they see their airplanes moving on the ground and stuff. It's called Airport Surface Detection Equipment, or ASD is the shortened word for it. But that makes sense, that like somebody could argue, oh, but if everybody saw this, how can a tower that's so tall and looking out the window all the time not see this thing? Well, it's possible that they could have missed it.
Just a very specific vantage point, I guess.
Yes.
And I think the fact that it punched a hole in the clouds, too, like they tried to explain that off with some kind of bizarre weather scenario. But I mean, even if, you know, even if you could explain it with that, it doesn't change the fact of everyone that saw it before it went through the fucking clouds, right?
What are the chances?
I know. So I thought that it was interesting because they came back and stated the whole punch cloud weather phenomenon. They didn't. I don't think they initially gave that as the explanation. And I guess I have some explanation to that explanation. And what I mean by that is, most of the time when media contacts us, trying to get information. We're so busy with other things, we just want to get them off the phone. So we'll tell them something like, we don't know anything, or will this or that. I can give you a number, and we'll sort of like pass the buck to a supervisor or another manager. So that's possible that this could have happened in the air traffic world. As far as like, let's say the Chicago Tribune decides to call the tower directly. Well, most likely that tower controller is not going to know a damn thing about it. And they're just going to be like, oh, they probably weren't even at work yet, you know, when it happened or something, you know. So it could have been anything. They came back and tried to explain it. An FAA official came back and tried to explain it as the hole punch cloud. So the thing about hole punch cloud phenomenon is that it requires a specific temperature range, which is usually in the cold realm. and it was a pretty like mild to warm day. So right off the bat, the facts are kind of like, like, what are you talking about? That doesn't make any sense, you know? So that could be almost immediately scientifically, meteorologically disproven right there.
And so, that's what she claims in the book as well, is that, as we know, America is not, if they are investigating these things, they're certainly not making it public, right? And they're putting out disinformation about things. But she actually did reach out to meteorologists, right, to research it, and the findings are similar to what you indicated. So what does that say, Gene? This is you hadn't heard of this one either, right?
It's suspicious. I don't know.
And I want to add to that the FAA official, in my opinion, probably wasn't trying to cover anything up. They just didn't know anything about anything, and they just needed to throw something out there because they were being pressured by, let's say, a manager to be like, we don't want the news trying to get something out of us. Just tell them something and get them off your back.
Absolutely. So that's a weird one. Yeah, you guys, if you haven't checked it out, it might be something worth looking into. There's a lot of cool interviews that you can look in regards to the O'Hare sighting. But moving on from O'Hare, let's get into in the book. They also discuss a Portuguese pilot that was circled by a UFO, and I thought that this one was pretty interesting. In 1982, Portuguese Air Force pilot Julio Guerrera happened to look out from his cockpit window down toward the ground below and saw a low-flying metallic disc. Suddenly, it bolted toward him at a high speed. During a lengthy series of events, the object demonstrated a harrowing variety of maneuvers at close proximity to Guerrera's small plane. Witnesses were also included two other Air Force pilots, in addition to him, that were called to the scene. And since leaving the Air Force in 1990 after 18 years of service, Guerrera has been a captain at Portugal's commercial airline, and he has never seen another UFO since. But he does very vividly recall this life-changing event that he witnessed. And so it took place at 5,000 feet when he noticed the object, had no tail nor wings, just a cockpit, as he described it, and it was oval-shaped. He turned his plane and followed the object, only to see it ascend to his exact altitude and stop right in front of him, in a wavering motion before stabilizing. So it kind of jingled a little bit, I guess, before it actually became still again. And a metallic disc was composed of two halves, one top and one bottom. It took off with amazing speed, bolting left to right. He radioed into the tower and said that it must have been some kind of balloon. The other pilots in the different zones started making fun of him, talking about this, you know, this weird object. And so Guerrera told him to come over and see with their own eyes. He countered, asking, you know, if it was a balloon, how the fuck could it ascend from the ground nearly 5,000 feet in a few seconds? Like, duh. But he sat watching for 15 minutes by himself, and he says that the 15 minutes felt like it was forever, and it was completing an elliptical course around his aircraft while the other pilots arrived. So when they finally got there, They, you know, he gave the coordinates to the other two pilots, and they were able to see the object as well. They sat there for 10 minutes out, kind of outside of this weird course that it was running around his plane for 10 minutes, and they were just like watching it. Guerrero was in the interior of the object, of the object's course, while the other two were watching the orbiting. He attempted to make an interception, which, John, that's when they head directly toward the object, but then like they slide to the side. Is that a fair description?
Yeah, so an intercept is exact. That's probably the, that's an excellent way of describing it. It's pretty much just, obviously you don't want to hit it. So you want to approach it and be like, hey, I'm here too, sort of thing. It's common in like presidential, we're accustomed to it with presidential protection. When Obama would come to the vineyard, we would provide air protection for him. And if there's a lot of times that these little private airplanes that don't pay attention to the news, they'll try to fly into the inner circle, which they're not allowed to, and they will send fighter jets to intercept them, and that's what it's called. And it's just pretty much just you line up to line up with their course and let them know that you mean business and you're there.
Yeah, they're kind of just like, fuck off, you know?
Right. Or and this has a lot of similarities to the private pilot experience from Melbourne.
Right, part one, definitely, because he said it was orbiting, although it's not, he hasn't described it yet as hovering directly above, but it was definitely orbiting. Yeah, there's weird similarities.
Similar altitude as well, 4,500 and 5,000.
Yep. Good point.
What do you think makes the most sense for these objects? Do you guys think it's aliens? Do you guys think it's government technology that hasn't been released that they're testing? Do you think it's something else?
Yeah, I've thought of that a lot because my initial just educated guess would be that it is some sort of human technology being out there. I mean, I could think of a couple examples of why you would throw this out there. What ultimate testing then, trying to fool professional pilots, trying to fool the public, or, you know, let's say you're testing your radar observance capabilities or lack thereof, you know, because you want to be invisible. If you're testing the ability to shut down weapon systems, which there's indications and stories that the fighter pilots' weapon systems would go offline as soon as they're ready to use them, you know. All of that can have military implications of stuff that we don't know about. Like I said, the F-117, I think, was developed in the, I believe it was the Northrop Grumman Skunk Works, and it wasn't shown to the public, I think, until like, I don't know, the late 80s or the 90s, something like that, so early 90s. Yeah, I honestly don't know, man. I mean, that's what makes this so interesting, is that even a person like myself, who just has been into aviation for so long, and I can't think of, this has to be alien as far as extraterrestrial, or this could absolutely just be some sort of military or government technology that is that's just out there. And sometimes it's accidentally come across, and other times it's intentionally hostile for a purpose, for testing or whatever, you know. I don't know. It's all so speculative, right?
I think the reason why it seems so alien-like, I guess, is because there's nothing comparable. And the jump in technology doesn't really make sense.
Yes.
A lot of times.
And you know, you could argue that self-driving cars are in that realm of making the average Joe kind of jump up and be like, whoa, you know, what is this? Like, this is crazy. I don't trust this. This is weird. This is stuff that's been around for years, you know? So you look at online footage of like grandmas being put into self-driving cars and stuff like that, and they lose their mind because it's just not a comfortable place for them. The technology is so much outside of what they're used to. And that's a human
being. In their realm of possibilities.
Yeah. And to think that just blows your mind. And you could argue that that's what happened to the people that first saw the Wright brothers flying, the people that first saw or heard radio communication, you know, television. I mean, imagine the 90-year-old guy who went over his son's house and turned down his family's first TV set in the 50s. and see somebody moving and then look behind the box. And it's like, oh my God, there's nobody in there. Yeah. You know, like it's crazy.
It still blows me away, honestly, thinking about certain technologies that we've had for a long time. Because you don't really know, sit there and stop and think about how everything works, you know?
Works, exactly.
It's just there. But I think everything that you guys have speculated is plausible, right? It's all plausible. But I think two things to consider would be, one, Kane does make a good point in the book saying that in the type of society we live in, and you know, I'm kind of adding this, maybe how destructive we are as humans to each other, especially. I would almost think that if one country had this technology, that it would probably be used for wars, like she says.
Yeah, there's a part of the book where it says something along the lines of they would use it, or no, actually it was one of the pilots who saw something. I think it was the Iranian. He said that if somebody had this, they would just take over the world.
Right. Because yeah, we're fucking greedy people, like as a species. So I think that, but again, it doesn't mean it's impossible that it couldn't just be government stuff, right? Maybe it is, and somehow the United States has, you know, maybe that's why the United States is acting weird about all this, because it's their technology, right? Maybe that's a possibility. And why they're so different about investigating reports than all these other countries that are very cooperative, right?
And something that throws a little bit of water on that fire too is nuclear deterrence. Because what you want in today's day and age, what you want is you want somebody to fear what you're capable of, not necessarily taste what you're capable of. So you don't want to fire a nuclear missile. You just want to know other, let's say, enemies of the state that you have nuclear capability.
Right.
And if that were the case with, let's say that were in line with, let's say, the U.S. possessing technology like this, you would present it to the world and say, hey, we have aircraft that could shut down your weapon systems, move around in ways that you've never seen before in the physics world, and completely disappear in a split second. Don't mess with us.
And I think one final thing to consider, just as I kind of wrap up my thought on it, is maybe it's both, right? It doesn't necessarily have to be just aliens or just humans. Maybe we somehow got technology from aliens, reverse engineered it. So maybe the technology is alien being controlled by humans. That's one other concept. I mean, since we're talking about anything that's possible, right?
Yeah.
Maybe time traveling humans from the future.
That's right.
Right?
Yeah, no, there's so many different theories. There's so many different ways of thinking about this. But again, what I always come back to, and the book kind of reiterated this point, this sort of like this critical thinking part of me, is that the injustice here is the lack of investigation, the lack of, or sort of like the disrespect that the people that come forward risking their professional reputation, risking just pretty much any sort of reputation that you can think of because of how this is viewed in just general culture today, world culture, really. And it's just completely shut down. You know, there's no effort put towards it at all. And it's just mind-boggling that you could have so many examples, so much, well, witness evidence, and then on top of that there is some physical evidence, because there is, you know, there are pictures, there are radar images of stuff that can't be explained. In the book, it's funny, there's like a back and forth between technicians, radar technicians, where the software guys are blaming it on the hardware, and then the hardware guys blame it on the software. So they're both saying, oh no, that's something weird, it has to be this, and they blame it on the different components of the system, which sort of like makes you scratch your head and be like, well, maybe something is there. They just can't explain it, and nobody's investigating why.
A lot of possibilities. I'm glad we're exploring them all, because it's the most interesting part of it, finding out, or not finding out, but speculating, because that's all we can do until more information comes out. But
right.
But I think with a lot of this information, it's safe to say that it's certainly something out there that is unexplainable, at the very least, which is the definition of the UFO or the UAP. Going back to the Portuguese pilot, Julio Guerrera, as he's moving into intercept, he said it like went straight up. And then like we were talking about with that other thing, it was like hovering above him for a moment, breaking all the rules of aerodynamics. Is that a true statement? Is that breaking the rules of aerodynamics going straight up from a hovering standpoint?
Well, it depends, because there are VTOL aircraft, VTOL, vertical takeoff or landing. And what they are is, depending on what type of airplane you're looking at, there's one called a V-22. It's an Osprey. It's a military airplane that can take off like a helicopter, and then as it gains speed going forward, rotates the propellers sideways to then become a typical like propeller driven aircraft. Okay. Then there's the F-35, or before that, that's called the Harrier jet, right? You guys have seen that in movies, right? The Harrier jet,
yeah,
where it could vertically take off and then perform just like a regular jet. The new F-35, the Marine version, the U.S. Marine version, and the British version of the F-35 handles the same way. In all of these cases, though, the vertical capabilities of the airplane are pretty limited, and in other words, slow. So unless there's some other sort of technology that can like zip something up vertically, and I'm talking about pure vertical movement, right? Without any horizontal acceleration and speed that would then take it to a higher altitude. There aren't many airplanes that could do that in a moment that can be described in the way that this pilot described it.
Well said. And so after sitting approximately 15 feet from the plane, I guess this is where the UFO moved out, it flew off into the mountains. And all the pilots filed detailed reports about the incident, and the planes were examined for damage, but they never heard another word about it. Years later, a general who had had his own experience with a UFO, he had also, in fact, filed a report back in the days of Project Blue Book. He released all the reports and analysis of this incident. Briefly, too, just speaking of Project Blue Book, John, I thought it was interesting when we were talking, you said Alan J. Hynek, who was initially a skeptic that ran the Project Blue Book and oversaw that program, eventually turned into a believer by the end of his days. He was the one that wrote your textbooks, right?
He wrote many books. He's like an overall like aviation expert as far as human factors performance. And what that means is human factors is the study between man and the machines that he or she uses. And that could run the gamut from just the user interface through just human performance. And he knew all about this stuff. He wrote a lot of the textbooks that I had in my courses when I was doing my university studies. So it was pretty interesting to see his name when I read the book, because I'm like, holy crap, yeah, this guy was probably on at least 3 to 4 of my courses in the textbook that was required for the course. So he definitely is the subject matter expert when it comes to this stuff.
Definitely. So contrary to what we see in American investigations of UFOs, which is essentially nothing, in Portugal, between the years of 1983 and 84, they brought in 30 historians, engineers, scientists, meteorologists, all different people, right? And they assisted with this extended study. And the scientists cooperated with the military, right? They worked together to perform different recreations even. And Guerrera returned to the exact same zone that he flew, and he flew that same path again that he did when he saw the UFO, you know, so they could do like a mock of it. And they were able to determine that it was flying over 300 miles per hour vertically when it shot up, which is not possible for a helicopter at that speed. And Kane claims in the book that if a human was inside, that it wouldn't be able to survive the G-force of the acceleration. And John, could you talk a little bit about G-force? Because I think that's probably something that needs explanation.
Yeah, so there's no... So just real quick, so G-force is gravity. It's called G-force because it is it's linked to gravitational force on your body. So 1G is the amount of force or acceleration that is on your body here on Earth. That's one gravitational force, 1G force. It's equivalent. So it's pretty much speed. Or acceleration, which is speed, it's a factor of speed exponentially. And what I mean by that is, to give you numbers, gravitational acceleration is about 9.82 meters per second square or 32 feet per second square. And that's just a normal pull on your body. So that's what keeps you planted to the ground. If you double that, think about a force the same as your mass doubling down, like you carrying yourself. Think of your legs as you carry yourself. That's 2G, 3G, 4G, 5G, 6G, 7G. That's how you'll see it explained in certain things. And it's sort of like how pilots describe it in high-performance airplanes. It's like an elephant on their chest because you get physiological effects with positive Gs that can lead to your blood rushing to your legs, therefore giving you the sense that you're losing. First, you lose your color vision, and then you black out. So the body, the human body, physiologically can only take so many Gs. Now, it can take a lot of Gs, depending on how fit you are, what kind of equipment you have on. Astronauts, they go through this crazy training where they're put in a centrifuge type thing, and they get spun around for training so that they can acclimate their bodies to it. A typical fighter pilot, because of the equipment they have, and by equipment I mean these sort of pants that circulate water or air that pump into these pants, and they squeeze their legs, pushing the blood back to the torso and therefore back into the head. They keep them conscious. They could get upwards of 9, maybe 10 Gs if the airplane structure could take it and not pass out. So how many Gs does it take for this thing that went vertical? I don't know. He doesn't have any sort of like numbers to back it up and say, oh, it was traveling at however miles an hour in this amount of time, where you could calculate the acceleration and therefore calculate the amount of Gs that a human body would. But in general, G is just a force exerted on your body relative to gravity.
So basically, off the top, we can't say for sure if 300 mile per hour vertically would be like a crushing G-force to a human.
Correct, because it's a formula. So it's about how much time. So acceleration.
It took to get to that.
Yeah, so speed. You could be traveling at 1,000,000 miles an hour and not know it.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? Think about it. You're traveling at 1,000,000 miles an hour, but you're just sitting there because you're traveling at 1,000,000 miles an hour. It's the same thing when you're traveling on the highway, 70, 80 miles an hour on the highway. Not me, not around here, right? Because it's limit 65. I obey the law.
He's a lying son of a bitch.
Yeah, yeah. So you don't feel it. But as soon as you turn, as soon as you stop, and that speed changes in a moment, whatever that moment may be, you feel it because now you're accelerating, either negatively accelerating or accelerating to go faster. You feel that. You actually feel acceleration because it's a force on your body. And it all depends on that 300 mile an hour, if you want to put a number on that, how long did it take for him to move half a mile? How long did it take for him to move 15 feet? You have to have some sort of other numbers in order to calculate what the G force would be in that amount of at that speed.
All right. So, and additionally, they were able to calculate that the velocity was 1,550 miles per hour.
Yes.
Is that the other number that we need to?
No. You need some sort of time. You need some sort of time or distance. The velocity is just typically the speed. 1,500 miles an hour is not unheard of, even in high performance. I've seen an F-18 depart a local airport and get to 10,000 feet within, I don't know, like a few seconds, 15, 20 seconds, because they're just punching it up. But the key to this is how fast did it take them to get to that speed? And how fast does it take them to travel from point A to B? Those are the real numbers, because airplanes, like anything else, they have mass, they have inertia. It takes time to turn them, right? If you look at an airplane turn, they don't turn on a dime. They slide in the air because their inertia, they have to change direction. So they have to go from a certain direction and a certain speed to now a different direction at a certain speed. And that's what is the how aerodynamics work and how overall what you're talking about as far as the numbers. That's what's incredible about some of these sightings, is how fast they go from going one way to going the other way.
Yeah, and
which is not typical.
They stop on a dime too, usually,
things like that,
as they're reported.
Right,
but
not typical of normal airplane performance.
And I mean,
there would have to be an interior that stays stationary while everything else moves for you not to be scrambled eggs.
Correct. Yeah. Even a person that's perfectly harnessed, with a perfect harness, a perfect seat, perfect airbags, right? A person. What do you have inside you? You have loose organs. They're gonna just smash against your bones at that point.
Yeah.
You know, you don't have seatbelts on your heart and your lungs and your spleen. You just have everything in a cage. So there's only so much you can do as far as the human ability to survive certain maneuvers like this. And that's why airplanes don't even try to go to these limits, because they know that their limitation is not necessarily the metal and the technology. It's the human being inside.
Absolutely. And I think based on the two or so years that these 30 folks, along with the military, did this research, it ended up finishing with a 170-page analysis that they concluded the object had to remain unidentified. They had no way of identifying it. So in the long run, we don't really know about this one much more than we told you. So that was the Portuguese pilot that was circled by the UFO. And now let's go ahead and move on to gigantic UFOs over the English Channel in 2007. This one's pretty interesting. A short time after the O'Hare sighting, which we just talked about, on April 23rd, 2007, off the French coast of Normandy, airline pilot Captain Ray Boyer reported seeing two massive UFOs. The craft were witnessed by both him in addition to his awestruck passengers. He submitted his report to the Civil Aviation Authority, which that's like their FAA, right, John?
That's correct.
The CAA. Both objects were tracked on radar, making the story go national. Boyer noted the differences in how each country approached the two in timeline, because the O'Hare one, it was just like a couple months, you know, I think in between this sighting and, you know, America with its more secretive kind of approach, act like it didn't happen. And then he said, like, you know, he would have been shocked if the CAA did not investigate the report that he gave. It seems that the pilots in America are used to this kind of thing, is exactly what Boyer said. You know, kind of getting snubbed out and your story not being relayed. Boyer was not ridiculed and was allowed to speak freely to the media, unlike the experience of those involved with the O'Hare sighting, who, as we said, stayed anonymous. Didn't say shit. The cabin in this plane, I think it's important to note that the cabin was a little bit different, at least at this time. As the pilot of the craft, Boyer could literally turn around and speak to his passengers. So like they were like sitting right behind him. The visibility was good on that day from 4,000 feet. He could see at least 100 miles all around. When they saw the objects lingering above some islands, it's important to note that it was not just their plane. There was also a second plane that saw one of these two massive objects elsewhere. And this other pilot's sighting lasted for about a minute, and it was nearly identical to Boyer's. So there you go. Two pilots, two separate planes identifying a similar object. Now, he only saw one, but that would eventually be explained when these two pilots met. Boyer was able to confirm the reason that the other pilot didn't see the second craft was because it was out of sight. I guess he was aimed at 6 o'clock view, and he would have only had one in his line of vision.
And if you could argue too that if this would have been so incredible that you just have tunnel vision at that point.
Yeah, it would be crazy. I can't even imagine. But he thought at first that the brilliant yellow light might have been a greenhouse on the ground causing a reflection. But he said, based off of the angle of the aircraft and the position of the sun, that such a reflection would not have been possible. Furthermore, the clouds are at 10,000 feet, and they were covering the entire stretch of area where the sun would have needed to get through for that to be possible. And again, if we think about our part one episode, right, one of the items we began with, this is where we can circle back to the term trained observers, that terminology, because, I mean, this is a good example because a greenhouse, I mean, I could have never fucking told you, that would have never crossed my mind, you know what I mean? That a greenhouse would be on the ground and cause a glare. But clearly they're able to identify this because of their experience, right, John?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And that's a perfect way to describe it. I mean, it's all about experience. The longer you fly or the longer you fly the same route, you get used to certain things happening to you. You know, the way the sun hits certain things, the way that traffic, air traffic, gets in your way, depending on the time of day or where you're at. All of that comes into play. You know, I'll give you another example of something to do with the sun. When we call out traffic to other pilots, as far as like, hey, I got traffic for you. Look out for this guy. He's at your 1 o'clock, 10 miles. You know, he's a Piper Cherokee. Some guys will come back to us and like, okay, we're looking, but we're looking right at the sun. Sorry, like we're not going to be able to really see him. So just keep us advised, you know? And that's just like real world stuff where like in a vacuum, you could be like, oh, let's just point out this airplane and they should be able to see him. Well, yeah, in the real world, the sun's setting out west and they're flying straight west. They're being blinded by the sun right now. They're not going to be able to see shit. So in a way, that's a good point. And he also mentions he's above the layer. He's above the cloud layer. So he's just using common sense to say there's an overcast layer that we're above. The sun's not coming back up to hit us in the eye. You know, once it penetrates this cloud, it's not coming back, so it can't be glare. So little things like that, you know, start to kind of give sort of like more credibility to stories like this. You know, sort of chip away at like, oh, you're seeing something or that's not what you thought. You saw this instead.
Well, that's what I particularly like about this story and why I find it highly credible, too, is it gives you that thought process that they're kind of he's going through. You know what I mean? As he's seeing right. it. I mean, all of the stories do, but this one in particular, I thought is interesting. I think at this point he got the binoculars and he noticed that the light-emitting object was cigar-shaped. It was sharply defined and pointed on both ends. As he approached closer, a second object appeared beyond the first. Both objects were of a, quote, flattened disc shape. He passed the details to the ATC, air traffic control, and they had no contact. So he was like asking, you know, do you have contact with these craft, I guess. And John, right. from the pilot's perspective, I imagine that not having any contact when there's a UFO flying near you or in the area, your aerial path would be quite unnerving in that a pilot might be considering like what maneuvers may I need to make should one of them do a rash move, you know, because like you're not essentially communicating with these other things around you, right?
Yeah, so it depends because it depends on the rules that they're flying under. So there's two main rules. There's VFR and there's IFR. VFR is visual flight rules. IFR is instrument flight rules. Under VFR rules, you are required, well, this is in the United States, so like, you know, this is all the U.S. rules, really. But and for the most part, it's universal as far as the rest of the world here. You need to, under VFR rules, see and avoid. Okay, so that you maneuver your airplane however you see fit in the safest way to keep you, your passenger, whatever it might be, away from harm, terrain, things like that. IFR rules are a little different. IFR rules, because they're instrument flight rules, meaning that you could fly in and out of clouds under instrument. You don't necessarily need visual cues. IFR rules require you to speak to air traffic control and follow a predetermined flight plan and flight path. So if you deviate from that path, you have to have pretty good reason to do so. Now, that's not hard to get, right? If you're being challenged by an authority and they ask you, why did you make such a rash turn here or there? Really, all you got to say is, I was about to hit something, you know? And that's really it, you know? Unless you've been doing that often and on a regular basis where they could sort of like see a pattern that you may be unsafe and pull a license or something, you don't have too much to worry about. But for the most part, pilots will think twice before moving. Even when they're looking at a huge thunderstorm, they'll think twice before moving on their own and just ask us, hey, we need 20 degrees left. We need 30 degrees left or right. Can we do this? You know, so that they want to make sure that they're not disobeying any orders that we give them and also not putting themselves in more danger by going into the flight path of another aircraft that they're unaware of.
Absolutely. So as they got closer, the situation got scarier and the objects are now plainly visible to everyone aboard, even without binoculars. And I guess like this is such a casual flight that he even like went back and handed one of the passengers the binoculars at one point to kind of take a look at them.
Yeah,
like,
that's not uncommon. It sounds, I don't think they mentioned what type of airplane it was, but it's common for smaller airplanes that carry, let's say, 10, 12 people. Think of like a big van or even like a bus environment where there's no barrier to the cockpit. It's just an aisle of seats, and then at the very front is where the pilots sit. You know, so they could easily look back. Some of the examples around here are like the Cape Air flights. They fly small twin engines that seat about 8 to 10 people. And they're within arm's length of their passenger. Sometimes it's just one pilot and they'll have a passenger fly in the front seat with them. So it's just like an experience, you know? So that's not too uncommon. So that makes it even more interesting that it wasn't them by themselves up there, that they have their passenger sort of seeing the same thing.
Yeah. And this pilot was pretty cool. Like the way he was explaining it, Bauer was like, dude, I was a little freaked out, but I was also curious. Like, had I been alone, I probably would have flown over there. You know what I mean? Like, that was, he had this curiosity inside of him, you know, like, just at the nature. By nature, he loves going out and flying, dude. And this, he's seeing this miraculous thing. But at the same time, he says, you know, I would have never put the passengers in danger, obviously. I just fucking did what I was supposed to.
That is a very, very credible statement for me, because I have a couple examples of this. So first off, the author mentions this later on in the book when she's sort of wrapping things up. She says, hey, if we were able to properly investigate these things, we can ask pilots to go and check these things out. That's what she mentions along this big list of things, you know, in more ideal circumstances. I disagree with that. Because if pilots have passengers on board, they are putting themselves at tremendous risk. If they have paying passengers and they're going outside of their parameters of their flight path to investigate something, there's a case that happened a few years ago where there was a no radio or a NORDO pilot that air traffic control was trying to get a hold of. And they thought that the pilot may have had some sort of cardiac arrest or something. And they were concerned. So they asked a Southwest pilot to go and check it out. The pilot had no problem with it. Obviously, he's going to keep his airplane far enough away to do it. Well, he checked it out. He's like, nope, he's not responding. I don't see much. I think he might be in trouble, maybe. And nothing happened, except when the authorities found out that the air traffic controller and the pilot did this, both of them got burned because they used a passenger airliner to go do a reconnaissance and fly an airplane within parameters that are not allowed under normal circumstances. So it's sort of like a risky business type thing. So he is absolutely correct in saying that if with passengers on board, there's no deviating from that. You have to fly your flight path, get to where you need to be, and land safely. That's your number one priority. Everything else would risk your career.
Yeah. No, good point. I'm glad you explained that. It's interesting to hear it used outside of a UFO scenario and kind of how they would act. So at this point, when they could all see without the binoculars, because they were getting closer, the ATC then told them that they see them on the radar. And although Bauer said the objects appeared to be stationary, the radar would later indicate that the objects were moving away from each other at about 6 knots. And they would land safely without issue, and Boyer would file his report. Official investigations, which ended up running a 175-page report, offered no evidence or explanation for the sightings. So, another true unidentified flying object right there. What about you guys? Yo, I feel like I'm on a plane with you guys right now. I feel like we're flying together. Do you guys get that feeling?
Yeah.
Who's flying, though?
My legs are getting tired.
What's that?
My legs are getting tired. Gene seems to be in first class. He's lounging over there.
Absolutely.
All right. Well, guys, listen up. All of our wonderful listeners, if you're enjoying the most credible UFO sightings, then you got to tune back in next week for part 3, where we cap it off with a couple more amazing sightings. And then we get to the current news and we get a quick hot take from John the Aviator on what the fuck's going on with the Pentagon. We will see you guys next week for part 3. Until then, head over to evilexamined.com, check out the extra evil, check out the fucking website, check out the video evidence, the photographic evidence, it's all there, and please like and subscribe on our social media platforms. Thanks again, John, and we'll be back next week on Evil Examined.
You bet, buddy.
Or anybody else was in there against their will.